this year in the, what was it, Blue Ribbon Baking Competition? Wasn't that it?
It was America's, I think it was America's, American Baking Competition.
Oh, American Baking Competition. Anyway, we'll have her on the phone, and we'll be talking to her in just a bit. Also, you've heard a lot about R.J. Cooper over the years. Some of it is true, some of it isn't. But either way, he'll be in studio.
I think most of it's true.
With his new restaurant, Gypsy Rose. And I don't know about you, but once summer hits, there is one thing I want to be drinking. And that's rosé.
Beer.
No, rosé. I love rosé. I want it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's delicious. And we have with us today Wynn Robertson. You may have seen him skulking around Bourbon Steak. But today he's in studio. He's talking with us about the wines of Provence.
And Rum Day is back. What is it? I think it's the fourth annual Rum Day. Starts August 14th, runs through the 16th. I think it should be Rum Days, but that's just me.
I know, you've only said that like 12 times today.
Be alive with feature tastings and mixology and rum-inspired cuisines. John Peterson and Clyde Davis are the Rum Day DC founders. They're in. Trevor Fry, who is the beverage director at Jack Rose, has limped in wherever he is. He limped out.
There he is.
He's sitting down. And Jason Gehring, who's the executive chef. Mo Sherry, who's the managing chef. And Aisha Abalisha, who is the CEO of Mason-Dixon Biscuit Company, are in there, a Rum Day sponsor. We'll be talking to them. And John and Clyde, let's start with you guys. Step up to the microphone there. Come on, come on.
You can't sit there forever. You got to come up
drinking,
and talk.
You've been drinking too much rum. That's what it is. So
sure.
What's your love connection with rum, and why a Rum Day?
Well, for me, about 12 years ago, me and my business partner, David Jones, started importing rum from St. Lucia. The biggest thing when we started going to spirits was the fact that rum was an underrepresented category, a category that had so much diversity, so much history, but yet was underrepresented in American fine spirits. Every other spirit had kind of gotten premium, had become premium vodkas, premium tequilas. Well, when it came to rum, people were just thinking about, you know, rum and cokes and, you know, frozen daiquiri, but there's so much history and so much, you know, diversity in rum.
It had no respect.
Had
Is
no
that
respect.
Where you're going?
No
okay.
respect. Nobody respected
rum.
Rum
was getting dissed.
Yeah.
How terrible. So we're bringing somebody somewhere.
So we're bringing rum back to the forefront of cocktails and mixology. So it's been a great ride. So now this is our fourth Rum Day here in D.C. That Jonathan and I started about 4 years ago when it was just me and him going to bar to bar drinking rum.
And walking in. Yeah. Hey, it's Rum Day.
It's Rum Day now.
So you got about a minute or two here before we move on to talk about other things, but give us an overview of some of the events that are happening around town.
All right. So starting on Thursday, August 14th, we will be over at the Graham Hotel. It's the event is called Rum and Smoke. It's going to go from 6 to 9, so rum and cigars on the rooftop of the Graham Hotel. And then Friday.
It's a very shishi place.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
It's a hot place to hang out.
I love it. And then Friday, we have the Rum Runner Bus. We're going to be stopping at four locations. That's going to start at 6 and run all the way to about 10:30, 11. So we'll start at Farmers, Fishers, Bakers. And then from there, we're going to go to the event space over in the flats at the Atlas and Smith Public Trust, which just opened up a couple months ago.
And then you go to Lincoln, right?
And then we go to Lincoln. We end at Lincoln.
Awesome.
And then Saturday, we have the Rum Barbecue, which runs from 1 to 5 on the rooftop of Jack Rose. So have a lot of cool things lined up for people to come and enjoy rum and enjoy great cuisine.
All right. Well, we'll come back to you guys in a little bit and find out more about what's going on at some of those different locations. But Rum Day certainly sounds like fun. All right. Now it's time to get our workout
on. Gabby, I'm sweating just sitting next to you.
Okay,
for all kinds of good reasons, of course.
All right. So SoulCycle. Now, I know of it from New York. But tell us a little bit about it, because I think people have misconceptions perhaps about it. What SoulCycle is? What is it?
SoulCycle is a full body workout on the bike. And so we've really taken the elements of the indoor cycling class and added to it. So we dance on the bike. We ride to the beat of the music. You are moving on that bike like you're at a dance party on the dance floor. We ride in candlelight so no one can see you, especially if you're intimidated by a first class. And we also use arm weights. So halfway through the class, we pick up 2 to 3 pound weights and we do a series of arms while you're moving your legs. So you're really working your core as well as your upper body.
Why are you laughing?
No, because that means it's like if I do it and I fall off the bike, nobody will know, right? I'll just be lying
there. We just leave you lying there.
Yep,
no one gets you.
They just step on you on their way out the door.
Who's the dead guy? I can't tell. It's candlelight.
Well, so what was the evolution of SoulCycle? Because, you know, for like, especially in the early 2000s, like spinning was such a hot thing and everybody was doing it. But this has evolved from there. So tell us a little bit about the people who started SoulCycle.
Sure. So it was founded by two women, Julie Rice and Elizabeth Cutler, and they were looking for a workout that inspired them. They felt like there was nothing in the marketplace that was fun, efficient, joyful, and hard. Mm-hmm. And I think they looked at the idea of indoor cycling. Anyone can ride a bike, right, especially if it's not going anywhere. Right. So it's a great base. And then really incorporating inspirational quotes and motivational instructors who push you much farther than you would push yourself, but without intimidating you. I think that the idea that there's no intimidation there. And then really, you know, finding a dance party and finding joy in exercise. So amazing music that changes every single time. So you'll never hear the same playlist twice. And the whole room moves together. And the idea that you're a big sea of riders moving and pushing each other harder than you could push yourself. Mm-hmm. And again, there's no competition in the room. It's not about you riding harder or faster or stronger than the person next to you. It's you riding harder, faster, stronger for yourself and inspiring the person next to you.
Well, because I think that's for some people, I mean, personally speaking, like I work out on my own. I don't do any group classes or anything like that because I don't think I'm intimidated, but I don't like the idea of working out with other people. I don't have a reason for that. I just don't think I'm going to get the same kind of workout.
It's a sociopath.
Yeah. Thanks, honey. So how do you address somebody like me? Like, what is it about a SoulCycle class that will really turn me on?
The truth is you're riding by yourself. You're not, you're doing this for you. You're focusing on you and you feel the energy of the people around you, but you're not looking at other people. You're not comparing yourself to them because again, you're riding in the dark. So for me, I find that I feel the energy around me. I feel inspired and I feel accountable to show up to that class because people around me are looking to see that I'm there, but you're working out for yourself. Again, it's not about comparing yourself to the person next to you.
Okay. Now, SoulCycle is also like a way of life. You know, it's sort of Lululemon-ish, like, you know, in the way that people live. How did that come to be? That couldn't have been their initial way of thinking, but how did that happen?
I think from the beginning, SoulCycle was a community, and we've really focused on community, and it's more about community than necessarily the way of the soul life, although that is evolving. And it's treating people like you would want to be treated. It's feeling happy when you walk into a room. And that is really what SoulCycle is
the
about.
Golden rule of spinning.
But you don't want to call it spinning, right?
It's not. Spinning is actually a trademark. Mm-hmm. So it's indoor cycling.
Okay.
But the idea that it's...
You're not in trouble. It wasn't a dirty word.
No, you're not.
It's not a dirty word.
Is that really it's about creating community and supporting each other inside and outside of the studio. And that is certainly the SoulCycle life has evolved in that our retail has really become a business of its own. And, you know, you feel good. Part of exercise is feeling good in what you're wearing and feeling like, oh, I actually want to get up and put that on and get on a bike or go for a run. And part of the SoulCycle clothing line is that it's fun and it feels good and it makes you want to get out of the house.
All right. So if one is an intimidated beginner and you're in a room of people at all skill levels,
how is a class run? Like,
how does it run? How do I get help? How do I get instruction? How do I get, you know, where does that encouragement come from? If I'm hearing the whirring of everybody else's wheels around me and I'm chugging along at 2 miles an hour.
You know what? It's all about taking it at your own pace. Again, we're riding in the dark. So if you're going super slow, no one's going to see you. And the instructor gives you modifications based on your skill level.
Okay.
So if you're a beginner, they'll say...
So every class can be a mix of people.
Correct.
Okay.
If you're a beginner, you'll say, sit in the saddle and just take it at your own pace. Mm-hmm. We set you up on your bike. We'll get you your settings. We help you get clipped in. So the moment you come in, you are taken care of. From the moment you leave, we make sure that the experience, especially if you're a beginner, is really you can understand every single thing you're doing.
The room.
In DC, we have 58 bikes.
Okay, and it's just one room. It's just one class at a time. Like,
correct.
That's it.
That's it.
And how do people sign up for it? How do you guys?
You sign online,
okay.
Or you can call the studio. But the easiest way is at soul-cycle.com, and our signups are Monday at noon. You can sign up for the following week, so that Tuesday through Monday.
Okay, and how'd you get into it?
I was recruited on LinkedIn.
Were you really?
I was, yeah.
What were you doing?
I did PR and marketing for hotels for a long time, and 4 years ago got recruited by SoulCycle, and it's the best decision I ever made.
And were you already doing it?
I was not. I actually hated, I hated spinning.
Right.
And I thought, I'm not going to like this, but I'll try a class. And I loved it. It is so different from a traditional spin class.
So how many times, now do you lead classes?
I don't, no.
Okay. But how many times a week do you do a class?
I'm probably overkill. I go between 4 and 6 times a week.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But for me, it's the 45 minutes of quiet and even through the music, I find silence and meditation and it's much less for me. I started coming for the exercise elements, but I really stay for my mind.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how do you, if you start off as a beginner, how do you increase? How do you get better? Like, what? How do the instructors guide you to get more out of your workout?
Each time they'll say, okay, if you're a beginner, try this. And then if you've been a few times, try doing this, you know, getting out of the saddle, staying up a little bit longer. So, mm-hmm. and you also, you push yourself. So it's a combination of the instructor telling you what to do to increase your strength, mm-hmm. as well as you knowing, you know what, I actually didn't put two turns on that bike last time, and I'm going to turn my resistance up this time because I know I can do it. And the more you do it, the more comfortable you become and the better at, you know, at it as you get.
What about hours? Because people are working.
It's 45 minutes.
No. But what time you open? What time do you close?
Oh, 6 a.m. And okay. Our last class is at 7:30 p.m.
Okay. So it's an all-day kind of thing. Yeah. And it is only 45 minutes.
You're in, you're out.
And is there, like, a place to freshen up? Like, I have no
showers.
Idea what it feels like there.
Yeah, so you walk in. It's a beautiful, white, you know, welcoming, open, beautiful, sun-filled space. Mm-hmm. We have a back area with lockers for men and women with showers. We have locker space to keep your things. Mm-hmm. And then through the back is our studio. And in the front, there's also a beautiful retail space. But we do have showers and lockers for men and women.
Okay. Great. All right. It sounds like a lot of fun. All right. So where do people sign up? Like, how do they get the information? Right now, you're open in D.C.
Open in D.C. We're opening in Bethesda in
December.
Where is it
in Bethesda?
On Elm Street.
On Elm Street.
Yep.
So across from Equinox or?
Caddy Corner.
Caddy Corner. Okay. Uh-huh. Right. A little competition there. Oh, I know exactly.
So now we don't have
happening.
Any. Now we don't have any excuses.
No excuses.
And it's across from the Ritz-Carlton.
Correct. Across from the Ritz-Carlton on 23rd and M. You cannot miss it. It is a huge white box with a huge yellow wheel.
All right. Terrific. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you
joining
so
us.
Much.
Give us the website one more time,
soul-cycle.com.
All right. And I'm going to go to a class. I'm going to try it.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Booty and the Beast. We just got our exercise on, but next we're going into baking. We'll be back in just a sec.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me. Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking to me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. I have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. We got lots more to talk about. So Trevor Fry's here from Jack Rose. He's the beverage director. I want to talk more Rum Day with you and about your rumbecue. And Jason Gehring, I'm looking at biscuits and it looks like pulled pork. What have I got in front of me here?
You got to get in front of the mic so you can tell us what we got biscuits.
It's a buttermilk biscuit with pulled pork, rum-based barbecue sauce, and then jalapeno coleslaw.
All right, well, we got a whole bunch here in studio,
and
so everybody, please come and dig in.
Big time. So, Trevor, what's the deal with this rumbecue and everything going on at Jack Rose?
Yeah, so it's on Saturday from 1 to 5 at a Jack Rose. And a lot of people kind of associate Jack Rose with whiskey, obviously, because we have
that's
the largest
what you do.
Whiskey collection.
You see them lying on the street out front with whiskey bottles in their hands.
But we actually just took home the Rammy Award for Cocktail Program of the Year this year, and we really want to kind of let people know that we do a lot of stuff outside of whiskey, and rum is one of my favorite spirits to actually work with as far as mixology goes.
Why?
So I'm a huge cocktail nerd, and I like the history that goes into a lot of it. And as far as rum goes, a lot of people don't know is it actually dates back a lot farther in your classic cocktails than, you know, whiskey and cognac.
Rum was the
like
drink
that.
Of the colonies.
Absolutely, yeah. So,
it,
so Fish House Punch is one of the punches we're going to be featuring during the rum barbecue. That actually dates back to 1732. It was created up in Philadelphia at a fishing club. And I always butcher the name, so I'm not even going to try it, but it's actually still open. It's the longest running gentleman's club, not the gentleman's club like today, but a club where gentlemen go to
don't
meet and smoke cigars.
So
there's nothing hotter than seeing a cod do a strip tease, I can tell you.
But it's a very boozy punch. It has usually a Jamaican pot still rum with peach brandy and cognac, and then lemon juice, some sugar, and you're going to, you know, serve that over an ice block typically. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a little twist on it. Catoctin Creek actually makes a peach brandy locally. George Washington actually made rye and peach brandy back during the colonial times. So
they do a lot of that at Mount Vernon too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Isn't
they
that
have,
cool?
They have the original rye recipe going back and going. Mm-hmm. The peach brandy, I think they're still working out some tweaks from what I've tried, and for the price point. You know, it's a little bit harder to get.
Right.
But yeah, we're going to do a lot of really good stuff. So we have, like, you know, for people who enjoy that kind of burn of the alcohol, we have the, you know, the Fish House Punch, then a classic Planter's Punch, which I think the first print was back in like 1908 in the New York Times. That's a little more palate approachable, more refreshing. Usually use a dark rum, either, you know, passion fruit, orange juice, want something like very bright citrusy and then grenadine. Mm-hmm. And then you top that usually with either club soda or another kind of bubbles. And then one of my favorite cocktails that actually John and I were drinking a few weeks back is a what's called a dead cocktail. It's called an airmail. And during the
wait, just put
what?
A stamp on your head. And jump
yeah, exactly. So when the champagne era hit in the late 80s and early 90s, it was thought to be blasphemous to put any kind of champagne or sparkling wine into a cocktail. So this recipe for the airmail kind of fell by the wayside in the last couple of years. And I think it's probably one of the most refreshing things that you can drink. It's just, you know, it's a blonde rum with some lime in it, some simple syrup, a little bit of honey, and then you top it with Prosecco. So I'm actually coming up with a recipe for a punch that kind of goes along with that you know, that classic recipe as well.
All right. Excellent. Well, we're talking rum day. Tell everybody where Jack Rose is. We got to move along.
Yeah,
but I
2007 18th Street.
Right at the bottoms of Adams Morgan.
Bottoms of Adams Morgan right there at 18th and Florida. So.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Great.
Thank you.
So now we're going to move to a different kind of addictive thing, and that's Southern baking. Francine, are you on the phone?
I'm here, yeah.
Hi, how are you? So Francine Bryson was a finalist with TV's American Baking Competition. And along the way, she won the hearts and minds and stomachs of a lot of people, including one of the judges, Jeff Foxworthy. And out of this whole thing came her new cookbook, Blue Ribbon Baking from a Redneck Kitchen. And my wife and I just literally just got back from
Alabama.
A week in Alabama. And what is this thing with Southern women and baking? It's like, it was like a cult down there.
It's just something that we've done all our lives because it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. It always involves something out of the oven. Even from a very young age, you're taught to, you always go to somebody's house with something in your hands, and that's usually either a cake or a pie or bread or biscuits or something like that. So we're just taught very young to, you know, tote the baked goods with us.
And so let's talk about competitive baking, because, I mean, as David and I were discussing it, he was like, I mean, how many different competitions are there? And you've been in over 200. How did you get into competitive baking? And can you sort of educate my husband on the kinds of competitions that you did?
Well, I started when I was 16 years old, and my first competitive food thing was a pork competition where I made an apricot stuffed pork loin.
Mm-hmm.
And I won, and I was like so addicted to the competitiveness of it, and I moved on to baking right after that. I had done chili cook-offs and won those, and the pork and barbecue ones and won all those, and I said, well, I'm really good at baking, so I might as well try it. And I, you know, started with a little hometown cakewalk cook-off thing and won it, and I was like, okay, this is gonna be good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a competitive thing. It's like the Betty Crockers of America getting together and seeing who makes the best carrot cake or who makes the best pound cake and things like that. But it's a huge, huge competitive circuit. It's, you know, all the way up to Pillsbury. Pillsbury's been around a long time, and they've had the Pillsbury cook-off forever.
Right.
And that's what everybody's ultimate goal is to go to Pillsbury. And in fact, that's where I was heading when I got cast for the television show.
Well, here's so my... I want to ask you, though, I want to ask a question, because when you say the, you know, the Betty Crockers of America, it sounds so wholesome, but I'll bet it's cutthroat as all get out to get to that Pillsbury competition. A lot of people pouring salt in your bowl when you're not looking, or come on, what do they do? I'll bet it's like Dance Moms.
Well, no, and actually, it's not. It's a lot better. A lot of us are friends. I compete with a lot of ladies on a national level. I used to. I can't compete anymore, but... I used to compete, and we're all actual friends. We talk on the phone and, you know, Facebook and Twitter every day. So, I mean, it's a friendship along with competitiveness, but we guard our secrets. And I've always said that we guard our baking secrets better than the CIA can guard the president. And it's true. I mean, there's ingredients that we tote around with us, and nobody knows where you get them. No, and I've told everybody where I get mine, but I did it on national TV. That's a little bit different than telling your next-door neighbor, oh, guess what I use? But
how do you come up with those secret ingredients? I mean, when you're talking about sort of the classics, like what you have in your book, how do you experiment? And then, because baking is such a science, how do you find the right proportions without ruining it?
Well, one of the hardest things for me, I learned to measure with my hands. I mean, my Nana and Granny did not have measuring cups. So it's hard to explain how it's just one of those hit or miss kind of things, and then when you hit it, then you realize what the measurement should be.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes from everywhere. I mean, inspiration for, you know, new things come from walking down the aisle at a grocery store, or going into a gourmet food store, or with me, it's, you know, dreams, or riding down the road and, you know, see a food restaurant sign, or traveling the back roads of America and going to the little mom and pop restaurants where you eat something that nobody else has got, or they've made something like the praline bacon. Praline bacon is just all over the place now.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with the praline cookie from New Orleans.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's just inspiration comes from anywhere. The little secrets come from, I learned mine from my husband, carp fishing. They use the flavorings and extracts in carp bait to fish with. And when I seen that, I was like, and it's for human consumption, I was like, oh, we're on, baby. We're on. And it went from there.
Well, we know you spend a lot of time baking with your grandmothers and your mom. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about, because you write a lot about your experiences with them and how they influenced your baking. What are some of your favorite recipes that you got from working with your grandmothers and your mother?
My absolute favorite recipe would have to be pound cake.
Mm-hmm.
Pound cake is one of those things that anybody can make. It's very simple. It's very heavy. But it's really simple, and you can flavor it and use different flavor extracts and be any flavored you want. You can use the zest of any kind of citrus fruit that you want to use. You can use apple syrup in it. You can do anything you want to a pound cake.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my top go-to recipes. The other one is in the book. There is Aunt Thelma's chocolate peanut butter balls.
Mm-hmm.
I love peanut butter. I love chocolate. I love peanut butter cups, anything with peanut butter.
Right.
And she made these things when I was young, and the recipe was never wrote down. And she made me promise that I would never give any of the family the recipe. So,
but now it's in your book.
Well, I didn't break the promise, though. I put it in publication for the world. I didn't give it to the family.
Right.
Yeah, no, don't split any hairs right. there at all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have the most gorgeous biscuits in front of us right now. And one of the things you confessed to is that learning how to bake biscuits was really tough for you. Why was that? I mean, given all of the baking that you do, why was biscuits so hard?
Biscuits were almost impossible for me because I always overworked it. I wanted that perfectly smooth consistency or mm-hmm. the perfectly shaped rectangle to cut them with. And I learned casting for the show, that was our trial, was a Southern style biscuit at the Cordon Bleu in LA. And of course, you know, you turn over this recipe as a test and it says Southern style biscuits. You've got a camera in your face within 5 seconds going, if anybody can make a Southern biscuit, it's you. You're the only country person here.
Right.
And I'm like, of course I can do this. And they did not give me enough time to play with it. You had an hour and 15 minutes to make 12 perfect biscuits. And that's how I learned to make it, was not putting the pressure of perfection on me, just making sure they turned out. And I learned to make biscuits in LA casting for a national cooking show. So, but I overworked them. I mean, I think that's a lot of people's mistake that they make is they overwork the dough till it's tough. Mine could be used as weapons. They were horrible. But now they're just drop, gorgeous, beautiful, fluffy biscuits.
So it's all about leaving it alone, not overworking it. I think we're going to get an education in studio in a little bit.
What about the flour? Because you talked in your book about there's a lot of use of self-rising flour. Why use that?
Well, I use it because it omits other... I believe in cooking on a budget because I'd live on a budget.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the reason in spending extra money and extra ingredients that you don't need to buy because, number one, a baking powder will go bad really fast. It does not last forever. So self-rising flour omits the baking soda and the baking powder, which is two other ingredients you're buying that you don't have to. And you'll use more self-rising than you will all-purpose flour.
But, well, especially in a lot of your recipes. I was surprised to find where you use the self-rising flour in some of them. Which just it just sort of goes against the norm in a lot of other baking books, don't you think?
But it does, but it works. I mean, why go to the extra expense and the extra trouble to weigh out other ingredients and measure out other ingredients when you don't have to? You're creating work when you shouldn't have to. Baking should be fun. It shouldn't be a job, honestly. It should be enjoyable.
Well, and that's why we don't let my husband in the kitchen.
Because
it would be really unenjoyable. Last question, because we've got about a minute left with you. Let's talk about pies, because, I mean, that's one of your bailiwicks. Tell us what some of your favorite pies are to make.
My favorite, ultimate, all-time favorite is key lime. I absolutely love key lime. My second favorite would have to be the chocolate peanut butter bacon.
Jeff, that's what curled Jeff Foxworthy's toes. That's what made him, fall in love with you.
Yeah, it was Paul Hollywood that was utterly disgusted until he tasted it, and then he was in love with it. So, in fact, he's putting a lot of bacon in desserts in the UK now because of it. So I'm pretty proud about that.
As well you should. All right, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. Tell us where people can find your book.
They can get it at QVC.com. In fact, I will be on QVC this coming Wednesday night in the kitchen with David and for the second time. And you can get it at Amazon.com or BarnesandNobles.com or the QVC.com.
All right. And it's Blue Ribbon Baking from a Redneck Kitchen by Francine Bryson. Francine, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be right back.
Attention transitioning military and veterans. A military job fair will be held on Wednesday, August 13th at the Sheraton Pentagon City Hotel in Arlington from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Presented by CivilianJobs.com. Open to all transitioning military, veterans, and military family members at no cost. This job fair will feature over 40 local and national military-friendly companies who are ready to hire military-experienced candidates. Pre-register at CivilianJobs.com to be matched with employers. Free parking will be available for attendees.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
The National Building Museum presents Designing for Disaster, a new exhibition exploring how design, engineering, and construction respond to natural disasters. Discover how we can save lives and build more resilient communities. Featuring the interactive Wall of Wind, where visitors of all ages can test proof performance in hurricane force winds. Open now at the National Building Museum. Find hours and admission information online at nbm.org. That's nbm.org.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and sitting next to me is the esteemed James Beard Award winner, R.J. Cooper, who's the chef owner of Rogue 24 downtown, and now he's got Gypsy Rose out at Mosaic.
Gypsy Rose would be a bar.
Downtown. Gypsy Soul.
Gypsy Soul.
Gypsy Soul.
Sorry. That's, Gypsy Rose, you know, that's was my an bad. And I wrote Rose, too.
It's all right. That's Sunday morning, man.
That stripper I knew back in the day. Gypsy Rose. All right.
That's the overall theme of the show
you know
today.
What?
We're going to talk about strippers. People, that's perfect. Yeah,
that's a different show.
Okay. We'll both get in trouble.
Let's talk a little about how you got to where you are, because you didn't just start chefing at Rogue 24. Do a little of your background. Where'd you come from, RJ?
Oh. He came from Mars. Where do you think he came from?
He came from Detroit.
My mama's womb. Detroit via Chicago, New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a...
New York, I worked...
That is an engrossing story.
Well, but in Chicago, I worked for two esteemed restaurants. One of them called the Everest Room with Jean Joho. The other one, famous Italian restaurant that's still open called Spiaggia.
Mm-hmm.
Then Chicago is cold. You know?
It's called the Windy City for a reason.
Yeah. So then I went and worked at this little redneck kind of fish restaurant in Manhattan called the Bernadette. You ever hear of it?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, and you know, worked with Eric for a few years. Opened up
Eric Rippert.
Yeah. Eric
Not
Rippert.
His
repair. So, you know, Eric would write my schedule to be RJ, ARJA. So I told him I was never scheduled. So I never worked for him. Then I opened up the Brasserie La Cosa's for him, the one in Miami, the one in Atlanta, and, you know, followed this pretty girl out to Alaska. Then I moved back to the States, where I ended up here at my first job with the Oval Room. And then worked at New Heights. Then, of course,
Did you work at Toca?
I opened that place.
I remember. That's where I met you.
Yeah. Can we not talk about that one? Well, that was a beautiful restaurant. I just think it was a bad location.
Right.
I think we were doing some really cool food there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, through that is when I really met Jeff.
Right.
I met Chef Boobin. You know, and Jeff, out of, you know, all the great chefs I've really worked for in my life, Jeff, A, gave me the chance to really be on stage, and B, show me how to run a business.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, his first comment to me, I was sitting across the room from him and Mike, and he looks at me and goes, "You know how to run a restaurant?" I go, "Is that a question?" He goes, "You don't know how to run a restaurant. I'll show you how to run a restaurant. You could cook, but you don't know how to run a restaurant." And he taught me how to do that. I mean, cooking was always easy. How you operate is a big story.
It's well, being financially successful is
right.
important.
Absolutely. It's and you know, making sure that your staff is employed and, you know, you're doing the best that you can every
mm-hmm.
day. And that's where, you know, he really showed me how to do it. Then in my last 6 months at Rogue, where I was what he called me, the lame duck chef, because my tenure was done. I was
mm-hmm.
like the president. I got bored on Fridays and Saturdays walking around the kitchen going, "What am I going to do? Someone else is expediting."
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this happens to a lot of famous chefs and a lot of folks, you know, that are famous in their own locales, is when you have an operation that's running like a well-tuned machine like Rogue, and then you get a second location where you have to put your focus on that, at some point, do you, you know, how do
Does
you...
Does one suffer?
How do you maintain quality?
Well... I've always wanted to know that, too. Then I did it.
Okay. Beware diners.
Right. No. It's a better... There's an intimidation factor when the chef and the owner's there, that it's an underlying intimidation factor. You know, cooks get nervous. Staff gets nervous. You know, I always said that to Jeff, too. There's a different mentality. There's a different energy when he was in the restaurant than he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that both places now.
When the boss is there and the boss isn't.
Right, right, because we, you know, one thing, and this is kind of to my advantage, is he showed me about, you know, the thousand small details you have to look for to make that one overall detail great. And you know, with the, you know, the people who came through that kitchen, like Cahill Armstrong and
mm-hmm.
Eric Zebolt and Peter and so forth, and it really kind of showed us, you know, how to really operate a restaurant.
All right, well, let's talk about
the new space. Gypsy Soul, you're a Mosaic, you're out in Virginia. Why move out there? Why do this more accessible, family-friendly restaurant?
It's 10 minutes from my house.
Okay, number one. Let's go to number two.
Mosaic Center is beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's kind of the urban oasis right in the middle of the suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
Some great shops there. And, you know, it was 2012 when I had my open heart surgery in January. And when I was recovering, Jody McLean, who's the president of Edens. I mean, she really, we did a kickoff at Rogue where I took all the casual restaurants and I twisted all their food to a 24-course menu. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I really want you to come out there. I'm like, that's the suburbs. There's no way.
Right.
And
You're such a snob, RJ.
I sleep in the suburbs. I work in the city. I live in the city. It's in Judy, between my wife and Jody and the rest of the team in Mosaic, they really kind of pushed me into it. Mm-hmm. And when I was in recovery, I kind of looked at the space, and the space kind of drew me. It was more, you know, a feeling.
That was
of,
the space that Jeff Black was going to take, wasn't it?
No, that's where True Foods is.
Oh, okay.
And one of the reasons why I really like that space is because we're going to put a roof deck restaurant there next spring. We designed a hearth to go up there, a big bar. It's a totally different menu. It's more about fire and booze.
Let's talk about the menu because we're going to run out of time before people hear about Gypsy Soul. Not Gypsy Rose, but Gypsy Soul.
Tell us about the menu and what people can expect. And are you doing lunch already or just dinner
right
now?
After Labor Day as well.
Okay, so lunch and brunch start after Labor Day, but right now you're doing dinner.
Correct. The menu is very regional, straightforward. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, one of the food writers was in last week and he goes, it's very back to your days of Vidalia. Which it is. So we're really kind of.
But it's
touching.
Not as expensive as Vidalia.
No, not at all. Because again, we're in Fairfax County, and you know, it's number two, you know, household income in the country. But still, the people want a value. Mm-hmm. So what we did is take regional food, southern influences, a lot of cooking from local farms and so forth, and putting it on the menu. And the menu grew in the last 2 weeks. From we had two items and everything. And what I found was the cooks out there are really good, and they try really hard. So we broadened the menu. Anything, and we broke it up to fish, you know, shellfish. We have a pig section and so forth, and it's very approachable. Lunch, I'm looking at the lunch menu
here,
over your shoulder.
Dinner menu, here.
It's a lot larger than what it's going to be.
Okay.
So, but again, we want to touch on what people are going to eat. You know, the whole paleo. Fresh vegetables, protein is what.
All right, there's an item on here called sugared toads. What? Qu'est-ce que c'est sugared toad?
Man, you don't remember, do you?
No.
Sugared toad is a puffer fish from the lower Chesapeake. It's a bycatch. And they got their name because they're as sweet as sugar and they're as ugly as a toad. So. And I can't get them right now.
Wreckfish? What's wreckfish?
But how do you. Wait, let me ask you a question. In the suburbs especially, when people come into the city to dine, like on a Saturday night, especially the suburbs coming in, people are more adventurous. They'll order things maybe that they don't know. How do you educate the suburban consumer to eat, you know, anything other than, you know, salmon and their Chardonnay on a Tuesday night?
That's my favorite thing ever. What are you? No, it's just,
I mean, it's not
it's
what
training.
I want to eat, but you right. you know what I'm saying. The people who come
exactly.
in for a regular night's dinner, how do you get them to go out of their comfort zone?
It's value. It's it's how you write the menu.
Okay.
And not to be too crazy on the menu. I mean, we're doing some really kind of funky, cool stuff still.
Right.
Like we're doing shote. We're doing baby pig, and but it's how you word the menu, and you make them. You have to get a trust factor in them first. So,
sure.
You know, that's why we have swordfish on the menu right now. That's why we have quail on the menu and so forth. But then you start broadening the.
He's wrecking the studio.
Right. Broadening the menu, wreckfish. It's a reef fish outside of South Carolina. It's the only place
it
where
hangs
it comes
around
from.
Wrecks.
Yeah, it's delicious. It's dense, like a grouper. So.
Okay. All right.
Cool. I will tell people where they can find you, man.
Gypsy Soul, Glass Alley, Mosaic.
Okay. So awesome. Right now you're doing dinner after Labor Day, brunch and lunch start, correct?
We'll do brunch first, then lunch the following Monday.
All right, great.
All right. The famous RJ Cooper.
All right. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be right back.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide.
With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
$10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and we want to talk a little more rum day. Guys, step up to the microphone.
Not you, RJ.
RJ, step back, RJ. I can't let go of it. We have to pry it out of his cold, dead hands here. These are folks from Mason-Dixon Biscuit Company, Jason Gehring, Mo Cherry, and Aisha Abelisha. Did I do it right?
Good enough.
Good, why not? So you guys are one of the sponsors, right? And what's your involvement? And now you don't have a brick and mortar shop yet. You have a pop up, correct?
We're doing pop ups throughout the month of August. We open at Eats Place in Petworth for a semi permanent residency starting.
What is Eats Place? What is it?
It's the DC's first food pop upery. It's like a food incubator.
Okay.
So it's a startup space for companies that are still gaining traction with their investors, looking for the rest of their investment opportunity. And basically housing them and getting market metrics, menu tastings, all that. We're sharing our space. We're doing breakfast and lunch during mm-hmm. the day, Monday through Friday. And we're sharing our space in the evenings with another chef who's doing low country soul food. So
cool. Yeah. Cool. All right, I got to find out more
so
about
So talk
that.
About rum day slash days. What are you guys going to be doing?
Well, we're actually the guest chefs, Mo and Jason over here. They're doing the VIP dinner tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. It's a big media day. A lot of really important, cool people that are coming out. We're doing a 5-course tasting menu, all paired with rum-based drinks
mm-hmm.
From some of the rum sponsors that are going to be there tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about the kind of food you guys are going to be creating. Mo?
The type of food that we're creating is mostly harkening back to, like, you know, low country and southern food,
mm-hmm.
mostly comfort food. You know, the three of us are from Maryland. We grew up surrounded by soul food and eating collard greens, biscuits, fried chicken. So
mm-hmm.
why not incorporate something that we grew up with? Just something that most people are familiar with and just making it quick and accessible by putting on a biscuit.
And not all biscuits. I mean, it's a southern-based menu. So mm-hmm. 2 out of the 5 courses will feature the biscuit, our signature, mm-hmm. Jason's signature biscuit.
Right.
But the other courses are going to showcase some of our southern talents that we have that we do for catering orders. So
there's one Caribbean dish on there as well. My family is actually, half my family's from Trinidad, so we got to throw something in there.
Okay, so you're throwing a little.
Yeah.
So, Jason, let's talk about your biscuits since we had Francine on before.
Who had problems making biscuits. But so what is it that makes your biscuits so good?
I don't know. The only thing I could say is maybe that I know not to overwork the dough enough or too much.
That was her thing. She said she always overworked it.
Yeah. You have to touch it as little as possible, actually.
Okay. Do you use self-rising flour?
I don't know.
Okay.
I never even used self-rising in anything.
Big biscuit controversy here. There's going to be a throwdown.
All right, so give everybody information. So how can we find you? Where can we find your pop-ups? Tell everybody where we can
do it. So right now we have a pretty significant social media presence only. So mm-hmm. you can follow us at MasonDixieDC on Twitter
mm-hmm.
and Facebook. It's MasonDixieDC is the end tag as well. Our website's MasonDixieBiscuits.com. So please check us out. We keep it up to date on a daily basis as to where we'll be and the goings on.
All right. And we should make sure people know it's Mason-Dixie.
Right. Yeah. Not to be confused with the other pop-up that's in town. Mason-Dixon.
I know.
Okay?
It's so
Mason.
We got more battles going on here.
Hey, great minds.
All right. Well, good luck to you guys.
And that event sounds delicious. Where can people find out about that event?
The VIP event's actually invite only, right?
Yeah, invite only.
Invite only.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to get invited.
But rumunited.com is the website. You can find all the events
for
the weekend.
Yeah, it's rum-united, isn't it? Isn't that right?
With the tickets.
Yeah, rum-united. .ticketleap.com, right?
Okay.
It's a whole thing.
He says that like he doesn't know it's right in front of his face.
No, but I'm saying, isn't it when you're married, they're supposed to call you stupid behind your back? Not to your face.
No, all right. I'm very open and honest.
So am I. And I'll be open and honest as soon as this show's over. All right. So, Wynn Robertson is the psalm at the fabulous Bourbon Steak in the Four Seasons. Mm-hmm. And, he's in to talk about Nikki's favorite wine, rosé.
Summer wine.
Huh?
Summer wine.
Summer wine. Let's clarify. Summer wine. I guess you're working with the folks at
Wines of Provence. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So in their materials, they say that rosé, that Provence is the oldest making rosé region in the world, mm-hmm. and that rosé was, I mean, if I read it right, they claimed it was one of the first wines.
Yeah.
And yet in Georgia, like not Georgia the state, but Georgia the country, they say they invented wine.
Right.
Who's right?
It's always going to be up for discussion, I think. But it's definitely Provence was the first winemaking area in France. That's for sure. The Greeks brought it over in 600 BC to present-day Marseille. And the records show that rosé was the first wine being made there, probably because of a lack of know-how, and it's just kind of how it came out of the barrel or the clay pot or whatever they were making it at the time.
Well, just to clarify, I mean, let's explain what rosé is, because sure. I think there is a lot of misconceptions out there. People see a pink wine and they immediately go to, especially people in the United States, think it's white Zinfandel,
exactly,
which it's so dramatically not. Can you explain what goes into making a good rosé?
Sure, absolutely. The focus worldwide even is now on dry rosés. And what happens is the way you get the color into the wine is the juice comes out clear regardless of the grape, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And then the red skins are soaked in the juice. And over time, the wine goes from orange to pink to red. And basically, as soon as the wine is where they want it, they pull it off. Mm-hmm. Of the they drain it off of the skins and it's pink and they let it go.
Why
in water.
Make it that way? I mean, when they were first, you know, I know you weren't here when the Greeks were doing it. I was. I remember that well. But why go that extra step? If the wine comes off and you got something alcoholic and you get schlonkered, why worry about the color and the skins and all that?
Well, what about the taste?
It's just, yeah, exactly.
Well, do you think the Greeks, you know, were worried about, you know, refined taste?
Well, they had their own taste at the time. It probably is not as refined
perhaps
as ours.
What's wrong with the Greeks?
I don't know. I just saw that second 300 movie. There's nothing wrong with it. I had a lot of fun. But that's another show.
Let's go back to rosé, please.
But it's certainly more about it's more about the color, more about things other than the color. The flavors come from mm-hmm. the skins. The tannins come from the skins. So you get a little bit of that dryness, the structure. To balance out these wines. They're generally pretty high in acid, so you need something to kind of temper that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last about 10 years, rosé production has increased about 20 times, at least exports to the United States. So it's becoming really popular.
And what is it about the region of Provence that creates such a good quality of wine?
It's pretty easy to grow grapes. Grapes are supposed to be hard to grow, mm-hmm. but in Provence, with the Mediterranean influence, it's very dry. There's never any risk of mold. There's never any risk of rot. So the grapes grow very easily. It's done very organically. It goes with the cuisine as well. Mm-hmm. They're eating a lot of fish. They're eating a lot of fruit. And the rosés are super fruit friendly. They'll go with just about anything.
Why do some people poo-poo rosé, like it's neither fish nor, well, it's neither red nor white.
Well, I think it's gaining traction.
It certainly is. And like any kind of wine or almost any kind of product, there's a lot of bad rosé. There's right. a lot of bad white wine. There's a lot of bad red wine. So
we're not naming names. We're just
No, certainly not. It's just a fact of life. And
Boone's Farm. Sorry. I couldn't help myself.
No. RJ likes Boone's Farm. I'm sure it's on his menu.
Then I better go to Gypsy Rose instead of Gypsy Soul. Because no, but I mean, you know, what is that, just snobbery from the...
I mean, it can be, yeah, for sure. There's certainly a place for rosé, be it on a patio, be it with the right food. And, you know, it's just super easy to drink now. It's more in the dry style, which is much more the worldwide palate. So people are enjoying that more.
What
so
do they do to attain a drier style?
They just ferment the sugar.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's all
yeah.
it adds.
When, if you're making an off-dry rosé, you can stop the fermentation when there's still some sugar left in the juice.
Okay.
So here in Provence, actually legally, they have to get it down to 3.5 grams per liter of sugar in the wine, which is barely perceptible to a drinker.
So I have a question because I don't know spit about this. Champagne is a wine. But it's bubbly.
Yes.
Well, how do they make champagne bubbly and sparkling rosé and all that? What's the process there?
So it's called the champagne method, actually. And in champagne,
there you go.
Bish tosh. Of course it is.
They're actually allowed to do it two different ways. They're allowed to do the short maceration with the skins that we talked about, but they're also allowed to blend white and red wine in champagne. And then they make a regular still wine. They put it in the bottle that you actually buy it in. And then they ignite another fermentation with some more sugar and some more yeast in that bottle. And they cap it, and that traps the gas in.
And that's what makes the bubbles.
And that's what creates it. Yeah. But a sparkling rosé, is it made in the same process as a regular rosé is made?
No. All of the rosés, at least in France, have to be made from what's that Saignée method, the draining out of the soaking tank.
And so let's talk about buying rosé here in the States. If you're looking at French rosés, I mean, they're fairly reasonably priced, but every now and then you'll see a very high-priced one.
Sure.
Can you talk about some of the brands and some of the recommendations you would make?
Yeah, absolutely. There's Miraval is very popular right now, probably because it's good and it's also made by, or it's at least sponsored by Angelina and Brad.
It's the one in the funky bottle, right?
Yeah, it looks like they ruined our
bottle. Yeah, we were just hanging with them in Alabama.
Yeah, we were.
Nice people.
But we did try it. It's very good.
It's really nice. It's dry. It's lean. But it's very bright. It's the acid levels are certainly there to make it very refreshing. On even the higher end than that, there's some wines with some new oak on it. It's kind of still in maybe an experimental stage, but that'll give it a little bit more of a sweet tone, but also a little bit more like a sour. Kind of dillish tone to the wine as well. So those are getting more complex. And oak is expensive. Oak barrels cost, minimum $900 if you're buying them new, which some producers in Provence are now. So that's definitely going to drive the price up on the high end.
Okay. But you know, when I hear oak, I think California Chardonnay.
Sure.
And I think that's not a flavor I want. Do you know that big oak butter? So
how
does oak impart nicely on a light rosé?
It adds a little bit of that vanilla. Again, oak is a flavoring component that can be added a little bit or can be added a lot. And it's all about integration. So how the vanilla tones, maybe a little bit of coconut, some smoke, some toast, a little bit of butter and cream, those will interact with the fruit flavors. And it's all about the blending at that point. That's where the winemaker really does his job. He'll blend some parcels that have oak, some parcels that don't have oak, and figure out how to get it to where he wants it to be. Mm-hmm. Or she.
Okay. Right,
it's Greek
course.
To me.
Okay, it's not Greek.
Right back to the Greeks. Okay. Yeah, isn't that great how I do
and
that?
You can find rosé at all area markets,
anywhere, yeah.
right? They're all over the place now.
And you can find Wynn Robertson at the Four Seasons in
Bourbon
Steak. He's a tall, blonde dude. You can't miss him, and he knows everything about everything. So, Wynn, thanks very much.
Thanks for having
That's
me.
Kind of it. The show's sort of over. Everything you heard about on the show today and lots more you're going to find on the list or youwantit.com, Nikki's website. You can join about 35,000 other folks who subscribe to it. Follow Nikki on Twitter. You can listen to her on WTOP every Sunday at 12:50.
Pimento cheese is in the house.
Every Thursday. Well, I'm getting to that. Every Thursday at 11:50. I don't know. So they keep moving that around. But also on
WTOP.
They
really don't. It's the same time every week.
And you can listen to us on the Relm Radio Network. It's relmnetwork.com. And the shows are on demand. So if you want to hear an old show that you want to go back to, you can go to our archive on Federal News Radio or listen to it on Relm. And that's all I got to say, except RJ just showed up with pimento stuff.
Thank you.
Jeff showed up.
Jeff, yay. Hey, thank Jeff. You. Because that would go perfectly with our biscuits.
Yeah, give me a spoon.
Well, right. Southern thing.
We do got a lot of Southern things going on in studio today. But next week will be no slouch either. Do you know DC Beer Week is on its way?
Yay.
DC Beer Week. Every year we do a show and we bring in all the beer makers in the region. So we'll have all of them in studio. We'll be talking about all the new beers that they're making, what kind of craft brewing is going on, and of course all the events. I think there's over 150 events happening.